Welcome to the Time Bubble Podcast, the only podcast where you get to travel in time. And I'm very pleased to welcome today my special guest, Lucinda Clark, who is a professional writer since 1986, having worked extensively in radio in various countries such as Libya and South Africa, and has in recent years turned her talents to writing novels. Welcome, Lucinda.
Thank you very much for having me, Jason. Pleased to be.
Yes, you're very welcome. So yes, tell us a little bit about your time in Africa as a writer.
Well, have you got about 24 hours?
Well,
the reason I actually wrote the first book, I'd come over to Spain. We'd left South Africa to come in Spain to retire. And I got bored very quickly. And then it dawned on me that I was forgetting things. People would say, "Do you remember the time when?" And I thought, "No, I don't remember." So I sat down and I wrote a book. First of all, a personal memoir of what I, you know, the basic outline of my life and where I'd been, and the 9 countries I've lived in. And then I decided that I would write another book about my writing career from, you know, when you're at school and you say, I'd like to be a writer. And the family look at you as if you actually had said, "I want to buy a large box of red light bulbs and move to Amsterdam and rent a window." They would have been less shocked.
Yes.
So that ended up with 2 books. So I've now got 3 books. And if I want to know what I've done, I have to sit down and read them.
Yes, I understand that. Yeah, I started off writing nonfiction myself, sort of diary style books, and frequently look back at those now and reminds me of stuff that I've completely forgotten about. So, okay, well, let me explain what we're going to do today, and for the benefit of the audience, because this is one of the first episodes I've recorded. The Time Bubble podcast is based loosely on concepts in the time travel books that I've written, in particular a book called Midlife Crisis, where the main protagonist gets to travel back through time.
Which is brilliant, by the way. I'm just going to interrupt you there, Jason, to say I love the Time Bubble series and I highly recommend them to anybody who's listening.
Thank you. Plugs are always welcome. And of course, as we go on and before we finish, you'll have opportunity, of course, to talk about your books, which are also excellent. So, okay, we've done the back-slapping little section there. So, yeah, so we're going to have 5 questions today. I'm going to ask you to tell me about 3 days of your life that you want to travel back through time, live over again. And we are also going to have the opportunity for you to tell me about a famous person, past or present, who you would like to step into the shoes of for a day. And also, if you could, as yourself, go anywhere in space or time, where would you go? So we'll tackle each of those in turn, and we'll do the 3 days from your own life first. So without further ado, let's enter the time bubble. You see, I probably should have some sort of special effect in at that point, but I don't think I'm technical enough to do that. So, so if you could choose a day of your life, any day to go back to, where would you go first?
This was a really difficult question to answer, to be quite honest, because for every day, and I have chosen 3 days, there were pros and cons. So the first day I chose was the day I was born. Now, I was born into a family that was totally dysfunctional. I was an only child, which I hated. Secondly, my father died when I was 2. So I had this, it was just my mother and I, which was a battle, probably from day 1. And I didn't realize at the time she had a personality disorder. So I had a miserable childhood. So
I remember your first book that I read was called Walking on Eggshells, which was all about that experience. So, yes, I remember it well. So, yes, tell us more.
But on the other hand, having said that, I do think that the grounding I had with her, being able to read her mood, being able to see how she's going to react, read body language and so on, really served me well later in life. I was one of those people that would say, I will only be interviewed by Lucinda because she's the only one that gets the facts right. which was, to my mind, a tremendous thing to hear. And I learned a lot of self-control, and I learned a lot to put up with a load of nonsense we had to later in life. And I think I became a stronger person. I'm probably a bit weird to a lot of people, I don't know. But on the other hand, I think the upbringing I had in the end served me very, very well. So despite the fact I was so miserable, I think I came out of it with more tools to cope with life than possibly a lot of people who had grown up in a happy family with brothers and sisters who all loved each other. And looking back on it, I'm actually quite pleased that happened.
I think there's definitely a case that people do draw strength from adversity. I imagine, you know, it must be a very traumatic experience and probably quite difficult for people that have grown up in the bosom of a loving family to really contemplate. So how old were you when you sort of broke away and left home?
Well, I broke away when I was 20. Well, I went away to college. I went up north to Liverpool from the West Country. So to some extent, I broke away then. But then I ended up teaching not very far away because I trained as a teacher initially, not very far away. And I had to go home every weekend to sit with mom and have a miserable time. So it wasn't really until I got married. And then, of course, that was that would bring us on to day two. But that did sort of take me away. But I never actually left that all behind right up to the day I sat by her bedside as she died. So that sort of solved my conscience, because a lot of reviewers have said, oh, I wouldn't have put up with that nonsense. I mean, this is a very much a modern type way of thinking.
Yes.
Oh, I would have walked away. I would have told, you know, given her two fingers and walked out the door. But when you're trained like a Pavlov dog from, you know, virtually embryo situation, you do react in a certain way, and it's very hard to break away from that.
So if you could go back to that first day, obviously as an infant, it's you don't have a great deal of control of what you can do, but is it something you would change perhaps to but of course that would then change your entire life. So
exactly,
would you stay as it was, or would you perhaps try and do something differently? Or and then,
I would stay as it was, actually, because I've had a roller coaster of a life, and I've often said that if I get run over by a road roller tomorrow, I will have really lived a life that a lot of people don't believe the things I've done, so I don't talk about them very often. It's just I've had an amazing life, and I have no, from that point of view, no regrets.
No, I mean, having read, you know, all of your books, both the fiction and non-fiction, there's an incredible amount in there. You've packed a lot more into one lifetime than certainly many of us have. Okay, so that's interesting. So, okay, let's move on to your second day. So we've had your birth. What have we got next?
Well, the next was when I was 23, I got married. Now, having brought up with somebody who was totally controlling, and if you want to sort of imagine my mother, if you like, she was like Meghan Markle and Trump rolled into one.
Right.
So you get the idea, right? And I married this Walter Mitty guy who love bombed me to hell and gone. And he had the most amazing ideas, but he dangled a carrot in front of me that I could travel. I could live somewhere where it was warm. We could have an exciting life. We would see the world. We would do this, that, and the other, which certainly came true, but not quite the way he described it.
Okay. Right?
We got into some very sticky situations in a number of countries, and it wasn't pleasant at the time, but looking back, it was interesting, to say the least.
Right.
So, yes, that would be day two.
Do you see that as a positive experience? I mean, so if you could go back to that wedding day, would you go through it, or would you jilt him at the altar and run off and have a different life? Or I mean, you say that it wasn't all as you expected, so obviously you're not married to him anymore, so that side of things didn't work out. So knowing that, would you still go through with that, or would you take a different course?
Jason, you know, if I hadn't married him, I wouldn't have landed in living in countries like Libya for 6 years.
Yes.
I wouldn't have fallen into broadcasting. I wouldn't have traveled, well, from Kenya. I wouldn't have been abandoned in the bush with the baby while he'd scooted off to the next country. I wouldn't have had the police knocking on my door. I wouldn't have, there was so much. In other words, as a writer, and if you look at a lot of books from people who wrote a few years ago, even, they were bartenders, they worked on ocean liners, they dug ditches, they ran IT companies. They've had a wealth of different experiences. And without those, I don't think my books would have been quite as diverse as they are. So again,
yes,
that's why I say I'm ambivalent. Yes, in some ways, if I wanted a really huge house and I wanted a huge amount of money in the bank for my retirement, etc., then it would have been a mistake. But on the other hand, I wouldn't have had all the experiences. So, yeah, I wouldn't change it.
No, I think experiences ultimately are worth far more than money. I mean, you can't take any of it with you, but at least if one has lived a life rich in experience, then it's a life well lived. So you lived in Africa for many years, and I've found that quite interesting reading your fiction series about Amy, the African adventurer, which I can tell is some of it is sort of semi-autobiographical about moving to a strange country. But it's absolutely fascinating because there are so many books out there to read and self-publishing, and really not that many so richly detailed about other parts of the world. And I've traveled extensively around the world, but I've never set foot in Africa. So mm-hmm. I certainly found those stories about just the customs very realistic, about how the, you know, the British, you know, dealing with the domestic staff and how people behaved and the stuff with the bush, and also the stuff you wrote about the various revolutions and political machinations going on was quite fascinating. But you've also written about your Truth, Lies and Propaganda book about working within the radio industry and the censorship and what you could and couldn't do, which I found that very interesting, because a lot of people talk now about how much censorship there is, you know, within modern media.
Yes.
So what was that like?
To start with, I was working, well, mainly in Libya, because I didn't do initially work in the broadcasting in when I moved further south in Africa. But in Libya, certainly there was, and I was a presenter and then DJ and book reader and quiz master and all the rest of it on the Libyan Arab Jemahariya broadcasting on 405 FM from whatever, and I was on four nights a week. I once apologized for having, I apologized on air for having the whole thing broke down. There was dead air, as we call it, the hissing noise. So when we got connected again, I apologized. Well, I was hauled over the coals for that. To start with, we used to read the news that came down from Libya on disc to stuff for us to read out. And to start with, it wasn't too bad, but then it got more and more, you know, like the terrible West were doing this, that, and the other, et cetera, et cetera. And me, along with the other English people on the radio, said, no, we're not reading that stuff anymore, because it was just vicious, a bit like the stuff that's coming out of Russia at the moment. And horrible propaganda. In South Africa, the most I found there was when we were doing a live broadcast from around the country at the time of the election, and everybody in the control room was for the ANC, and they weren't giving the other parties any air whatsoever. You know, if they interviewed somebody who wanted another party, that interview was just cut and not shown. So I got propaganda, I mean, I can tell it a mile off, and because I was sort of so involved in it. So yes, you have to be careful, more so possibly in Libya, although Gaddafi was a hell of a lot better than what's going on now.
Yes.
And I found, as I say, I've lived in nine countries, but when you move to another country, you follow the rules there. You find out what's what, like Amy did eventually. I mean, she got herself into a terrible mess. Now, as you say, the first part is autobiographical. But then, of course, I went off on a wild tangent. And no, I have not slept through the bush and climbed trees to avoid lions. You know, I've only been charged by an elephant. That was enough for me.
it was fun to read. So it was good to allow you to use your imagination that way. So.
Okay. Yes, an imagination that was just desperate to get out from the age of five when I read Enid Blyton and thought, I could do this.
Yes, brat. We all grew up with Enid Blyton, so
didn't we just? Yeah. She's banned now, I think.
I think so, or has been rewritten for a modern audience, shall we say. So, okay, so let's move on to have your third day that you would go back to. So what have we got next?
You can probably relate to this, Jason, because you mentioned to me before we came on air that you had also started writing books in 2003, which is when I, you know, published my first Walking Over Eggshells. And I wish then that I'd known what I know now, although my marketing skills are pathetic, to say the least. If I'd known and pushed harder, I think I could have got foot in the door and climbed the ladder a lot faster than I did. And now with 4,000 new books coming out every week, you know what it's like. You're just fighting in a jungle to try and be seen about every, you know, the crowd.
Well, there's something like 10 million books, self-published books now on Amazon. I think when we started, it was about 2 million. So there's a lot to compete against. A lot of good stuff and a lot of dross as well, to be fair. I guess you're saying if you could go back to when you started the self-publishing, right, knowing then what you know now.
Yes.
I certainly agree because, you know, you and I have been prolific. We probably, I've published about 15 books, yours probably a similar number. And there is no guidebook. It's a learning curve. And I mean, we work together as authors to share advice, but you go into this and it was a relatively new thing. I think self-publishing and Kindle has not really been around that long, sort of 15 years, something like that. And yeah, I mean, now I feel, I wouldn't say go so far as to say I'm an expert on publishing, but you know, I think I'm pretty sound at what I do. And I would guess you would say the same.
Yes. In those days, I mean, I personally think that your books are a high standard. I like to think mine are. And there was, as you say, a lot of dross out there. I'd been traditionally published in 1990 by Heinemann and by Macmillan because my commissioning editor moved from one company to another. And I did think at the time, shall I look up my old contacts and try and get a publishing contract and et cetera. And then I thought, well, you know, by the time they've chosen the cover and they've decided who edits it and they take bits out and put bits in and all the rest of it, and it takes 18 months to get out on the bookshelves, I thought, I don't have that sort of time to hang about. And, you know, Jeff Bezos gave us the opportunity to self-publish, which was brilliant. Yes. But I wish now that I'd started getting a reader list together, making myself more obvious on Facebook. I'd never used Facebook before, Twitter, all the various things. And I wish I'd really made a big start then and a big push to sort of get out there. And when you think that people like Stephen Leather and Stephen King and those now self-publish, it just shows you that the publishing houses are not taking anything that's particularly good or different or anything. They're just taking stuff that sells or they think will sell.
Well, it's the same with the movie industry. This is why we get constant, you know, Fast and Furious Volume 9 and Jurassic this and Batman this. Nobody's taking chances on new ideas. But I mean, the traditional publishing industry itself, someone would have to make me a very good offer for me to go with that now, because I love doing it myself. I love the self-control that, you know, that I design the covers. I know exactly what's going on with the sales and marketing. Whereas with a traditional publisher, you know, they may give you some money up front, but you're very much in their hands. And you don't, I would imagine most people don't really know what's going on. And our books, we have that freedom to write whatever we want. We don't have to be pigeonholed. So is it a romance? Is it a science fiction? Is it humor? Say, oh, well, it's got bits of all of that. Oh, no, we can't have that. Where would we put it on the bookshelf? So,
yes.
So,
One sentence that sticks out, I think, from Truth, Lies and Propaganda book two, or more Truth, Lies and Propaganda, was I wrote, and I was thrilled at the time, my publisher took me out to lunch. And I thought, this is it. This is the pinnacle. This is what I've dreamt of since I was, you know, on two legs. And it wasn't until, in fact, after 2013, and I investigated the self-publishing and the publishing, that I realized that I paid for that lunch. Because they take all their costs, their books, you know, the covers, the editors, yeah. They take that out of your royalties before, you know, and give you a little dribble until everything's paid off. And then they pay you the rest of the money if it sells. And in theory, that I shouldn't have been so thrilled about paying at the Royal Hotel in Durban for a fantastic lunch with wine and all the rest of it, because in the end, it came out of my royalties.
Yeah. I know it must be, unless you are a really big name, it's probably almost impossible to make a living with a traditional publisher. I think, you know, we get, you know, a good chunk back of what we do with the self-publishing. Yes. And, you know, I like the fact we can see in real time every day how we're doing. We can advertise and we can see the effects of all that. You just wouldn't have any of that if you hand it all over to them. So we're our own business, really, effectively. And I like that.
Yes. And also, we don't have the stress of thinking, I've got a deadline to get another book out.
Yeah.
And if they don't like the first one, they're going to cancel the contract and so on. It's, we don't have that stress. The fact that, you know, they might dump us at any minute, and all the books that you saw maybe in WH Smith's and other places like Waterstones just go back into the warehouse and they get pulped.
Yeah.
Must be. I couldn't bear it to see that happen.
No, me neither. Okay, we're going to move on to the second part of the podcast now. So we've talked about where you'd like to go within your own life. So we've got two more questions. And the next one is, if you could step into the shoes of any person, past, present, fictional or non-fictional, for a day and experience what it's like in their life, who would you choose?
My answer to this would be the Dalai Lama, because I think he's such a wise man. He isn't too, what I think of as soft and soppy and everybody is wonderful and life is fantastic. I think he's very realistic and I have tremendous respect for his life, and I just hope he's not the last one in his line, which would be very, very sad. Well, I just think he's wise.
I think there's been about 14 of them, isn't it, something like that, since it started. And I mean, yes, the interesting thing about it is that we just had the Jubilee and a lot of talk about, you know, the Queen dedicating her life to the nation and such like. But with the Dalai Lama, it literally more or less is a job for life from a very young age. And he has actually been going longer in his role than the Queen.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah. You're right, because they're chosen at about the age of four or five, I think, from certain things that the people who are sent out to find the next Dalai Lama. And there are certain signs in the house and things he chooses and that. Whether this will happen again, he said himself, he thinks he might be the last one. But yes, I don't know how old he is now, do you?
I did look it up. I think he was born in 1935, which would make him 86, 87, something like that. So he's, and he was chosen at the age of about four, as you say, and had the role from age, but officially sort of took up his duties in around 1950. So he's about 2 years ahead of the Queen. So
yes,
but it's amazing to have one's entire life dedicated to one cause.
Yes, and also to not only just accept it, but do it to the very best. Both of them have done it, I think, to the very best of their ability. And you've got to admire that, especially in the modern day where everything is me, 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 and just what I want and what affects me, et cetera, not in my backyard attitude, which is very prevalent these days. I just think I admire both of them so much for what they've done.
There is an incredible amount of selfishness in the world now. And yes, though it will not be the same, certainly when they pass on. I mean, I'm ambivalent when it comes to the royals, but it's hard to imagine Prince Charles having the same sort of gravitas that the Queen has.
Yes, yes, very much so. But then I'll put a word in here for all women who tend to be better at serving selflessly than men are.
Okay, let's move on to the last question. As yourself, so it's not stepping into anyone else's shoes or within your own life, but if you could just time travel now to any place or time and see what was there, where would you go?
Well, now I'm going to go back on the selfish thing because this is all about me, me, me. But I would like to possibly pop about 20, 30 years, I don't know, into the future to find out what my checkout date was. And this is purely because I would want to live each day and I wouldn't procrastinate and I wouldn't waste time and I would try and accomplish all the things on my bucket list and things I haven't thought of putting on my bucket list. And because I've worked very, very hard throughout my life and sort of coped with so many different situations, from bayonet on my shoulder while I'm broadcasting live, to watching a public hanging, to getting caught in riots, to being charged by an elephant, to being abandoned in the bush, and all these things that have happened to me over a period of time. I would like to be able to use up all my money just before I leave and really enjoy it. So if I knew that I was going to go next week, for example, then I would sort of say, come on, let's book a cruise on the QE2 or whatever it is, you know, Queen Mary, and really enjoy it. But you tend to be careful because you don't know how long you're going to be around. So, yeah, that's what I'd choose. A few days, or a few years, I don't know how many, into the future, so I could look back and see what date I'm going to leave.
Wow. It's an interesting answer, and it sort of opens up some philosophical questions, really. See, I don't think I could do it, because if I did what you said and was given the date, I see the advantages, as you say, of getting everything in. But the thought of knowing what day you're going to die, it's like a... It's a death sentence. I would feel for the rest of my life that that I was on death row. I mean, we all know that we are going to shuffle up our mortal coil, but we don't want to know when. I certainly don't think that I would. I mean, it would be very nice. I mean, I'm in my 50s. If I did that and say, oh well, you've got another 50 years, you're going to make it to 100. I think, well, that's brilliant. But it still would be, once you start to approach the date and it's the gallows await, I think that would be
I want to go that way.
I think it would be quite a scary scenario for me, so I don't think I could do that.
Well, I have my my other half, because I'm very happily married now, again, to husband number two. He says, I've got my soapbox things. One is, you know, we're overpopulated, we don't plant enough trees, and, you know, we're not watching our carbon footprint and taking climate change seriously. But on the other hand, I just feel that people are talking about death more obviously these days, just as we never used to talk about getting cancer. We now are quite open about it. But if I knew when I was going to die, then I think as you get older, and I'm a little bit older than you, not by that many centuries, but a little bit older, you feel more and more out of step with the world. Things happen that just don't make logical sense to you anymore. And you get frustrated with how things are going. And you want to shake people and say, come on, use your common sense. This can't possibly be right. I think that is a kind of mental preparation for death, because you're ready to leave the world that isn't familiar to you anymore.
Again, that's quite scary from my perspective, because I've experienced what you're talking about progressively over the last two or three years in particular. But the world sort of starting to not make sense. And one of the reasons I write these books about going back to the 80s and 90s, because That's where I'd go if I had the chance. Anything pre-2000 was good, really, from my point of view. So, okay.
But the wonderful thing about being a writer, though, is the control you have. I mean, you create characters, you
Yeah.
can give them children, you can chop their legs off, you can kill them off, you can send them anywhere in the world or into space if you want, or back in time, like your books
Yes.
are. And it's just that I'm not a control freak, really, really, I'm not, but I can control my characters. So I can go into a world that is familiar to me, that makes sense to me, and hopefully my books make sense.
Yes, they make sense to me. So, having read most of them,
Excellent.
so that that's brilliant. Really great questions and answers. So, I think that was really good. Before we go, do you want to plug your books or tell us anything about what you do? Because I mean, I can certainly recommend. I've enjoyed all of them. Or where people can find your books if they are interested. Where would they need to go?
Look, one, right. I've got, if you like, four different genres. I mean, you're not supposed to cross genres, but I've done got the memoirs, which is Walking Over Eggshells, Truth, Lies and Propaganda, and More Truth, Lies and Propaganda. I wrote a daft fairy tale book about what happens in fairyland after the ball, that Cinderella wants a divorce from Prince Charming, who's, Poncy, etc. So that's just a joke, but very British humour.
Yeah.
And then I've done the Amy series, which is a girl who lands in Africa as a naive housewife. And over five books, she becomes a trained assassin and, does amazing things. A pure, well, somebody called me the new Wilbur Smith, which was one of the biggest compliments
That
I've
is
ever
a
had.
compliment. Yeah.
It is, isn't
Yeah.
it? That was a reviewer. You can find that on Amazon.
Yes.
And then I've done a series of psychological thrillers. And A Year in the Life of Leah Brand and Andrea Coe and Deirdre Flynn and Belinda Brand. And now I'm doing another one whose title I'm not telling anyone about. So that's another four books with a fifth coming in that, which have been much bigger sellers, in fact, than my Africa series. So maybe people are fed up with Africa, I don't know. And a few peripheral books around that. So all of them are on Amazon. All of them are in KDP, so you can borrow them. And at the same time, the paperbacks are on Barnes and Noble, Waterstone, all the various places where you might expect to find books. And several of them have been translated into other languages:
Wow.
Spanish, Portuguese, French, and Italian. So,
Excellent.
but as I say, they're all on Amazon, and my author page on there is Lucinda E. Clark, and they're all listed there.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It's been really enjoyable. This is the first episode I've actually recorded, and I think that went really well, and I hope listeners you enjoyed it. And if you did, if you're watching or listening on YouTube, please like and subscribe to the channel because we've got lots more on the way. And also, you can find us on all the usual podcast places like Spotify, iTunes, etc. So, all I need to do now is to say thank you to you, Lucinda. Goodbye, and good luck with the books.
Thank you very much, Jason. And thank you for giving me the most interesting questions I've ever been asked on interview, because they really made me think, and I had to, just not just what has your life been like, what have you written? That they were really slightly off the wall, and I think that's brilliant.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, and see you again soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.